From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk weird word origins. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do each week, language experts and New York Times bestselling authors Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Ross. We are...
Hi, Fletcher.
...now in lovely autumn. Have things cooled down for the two of you? Ross, I don't need to hear from you. It's always cool there. Kathy, how's Spain?
Ross is the coolest. It's down now just to the 80s,
yeah.
So it's very pleasant.
Yeah.
I'm not wearing tank tops anymore. I'm just wearing t-shirts. This is huge. This is huge.
Well, I'm going to pump in here because yesterday was 80 degrees here.
Oh.
And I had the AC blasting.
Oh, you see, we're like sitting in the Tanatsa going, oh, it's so nice and cool.
We went outside and everyone in town was going, wow, it's so hot. So whatever.
Well, we're going to have fun with some word origins I have learned today. But first, we'll take a quick detour to another listener pet peeve.
This is a pet peeve from Scott. He said, I have several English language pet peeves. You're just like us, Scott. But the one that currently jumps out at me and makes me crazy is using more and most with adjectives that should just end in er or est. I was taught that some adjectives are modified with er, est, such as nice, nicer, nicest, while others are modified with more and most, like intelligent, more intelligent, most intelligent. But it seems that nowadays people use more and most in many situations where er and est should be used. For example, every time I hear or see more proud or more healthy, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. I'm constantly correcting that in my head. Am I alone? Thank you in advance, he gets a little cocky here, for what I'm sure will be your agreements. And actually, we do agree.
Yeah, I mean, the general rule, of course, is, I'm sure you know it, Fletcher, too, is you use ER and EST for one-syllable words, and you use more for and most for polysyllabic.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But, of course, we're in English, and there are a lot of exceptions to the rule. For example, if the two-syllable word ends in Y, you can also add ER and EST. Uh-huh. I think most happy versus happiest. It's funny. Most happy sounds sort of snooty. Happiest sounds fine to me. So,
well, I can see going like, I'm most happy about that. Like you're doing it, yeah, with that edge.
Yeah, that has a slight edge to it to me, too. But that's the general rule.
That's funny that you bring up happy specifically. And I know I'm going to take us off track just right away here. But I can see myself saying, like, I'm most happy when I'm sitting at a baseball game. And that's different a little bit from I'm happiest when I'm sitting at a baseball game.
You're absolutely right.
What is the difference to you, Fletcher? That's interesting.
I'm trying to figure out if I can verbalize that. That's hard. I don't think I'm going to be able to.
But oddly enough, I think I was trying to do it myself because I was thinking, wow, Fletcher, you're right. And then I tried to figure it out. But I definitely feel, and I can't articulate it, difference between I'm most happy when at the baseball game, I'm happiest at baseball games.
I'm trying to figure it out because I think most happy means I'm happy. And when I'm at a baseball game, I'm at my happiest. Never mind.
I know. I think we should move along.
I just want to say, though, one thing that I want to clarify. The one syllable, two syllables is not really a rule. It's a convention.
It's a convention. Well, yeah, because, I mean, we have to do, and there are a lot of exceptions. I mean, this is the goodest show I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Good. You know,
real, rightest,
yeah,
longest.
My daughter had a sore throat the other day, and I asked her how she was feeling the next day, and she said, it's a little gooder. I mean, because she's, you know, whatever, she's four and she's learning. But
that's so interesting, though. I still love that how kids take the convention or the rule. I mean, we shouldn't say rule anyway. It's always convention. But they take that idea and then they apply and then they learn the exceptions. So, I mean, you know, we're going to hear later she getting rid of gooder and being, you know, better or whatever.
Just to address this really quickly, I think a lot of it is that people know there are certain circumstances in which you use the ER and there are others when you're supposed to say more. And people don't know for sure which is which all the time. And I think you're right. I think that's why sometimes you're hearing them say more when they should use ER, because they're not sure and they are trying to hedge their bets. I think that's it.
Yeah.
Like we've said that with myself, when people say myself instead of me or I. I also do think, going back to like last week's talking about pretension, I also think there is a tendency nowadays for people to want to sound formal for whatever reason. And I think the more sounds a little more formal somehow. It sounds a little more, you know, hotsy-totsy, no?
It might be also because they don't want to make a mistake a la Gooder. You know, they're slightly nervous about making an error, and then therefore it's easy just to say more, because like myself, more can be easily understood and it doesn't seem wrong in any usage, even though certain people do object to it. So I think it's also that.
I think that's just what it is, yep.
Interestingly, from what I'm reading, that more and most were around from the beginning. It wasn't until the 1200s that they were being used as modifiers. And then it was constantly used. It was like more and most were more common in many cases than ER and EST.
EST.
And then as time, even for one syllable words, and then it just kept changing. So it's just one of those things. And then, interestingly enough, from what I'm reading, one history of English was talking about how in the beginning a lot of three-syllable words were using ER and EST. So it's just been a mishmash from the get-go, is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Which is so typical of English.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to mention something else just quickly again. I was watching Ghost the other day, and which, you know, the film with Patrick Swayze.
Oh, right, yeah.
And it's sort of a fun, it's a fun film. It aged well, at least for me. But anyway, Demi Moore, she says, "I love you," and he answers, "Ditto." And he's always answering ditto, which is like a basic theme in the whole film. And I wondered, suddenly, where does ditto come from? Do we use ditto nowadays? I don't really say ditto very much at all. I mean, do you? Anyone?
No. I do.
Do you?
I think for me, I've always been slangy, so.
Yeah. I remember, and I think this might be part of why I never used it, I remember it being very popular with Rush Limbaugh.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't heard Rush Limbaugh at all.
I think his.
You're right. Ditto heads. Yes, ditto I forgot heads. That.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Anyway, very briefly, I wonder where it came from. I figured it came from Latin via Italian, you know, to say. But Kath, you want to weigh in? I asked you. I wasn't sure. But I figured that, and Kathy did a little research for it.
What I liked is it first came into the language in the 17th century, and it meant in or of the month already named. So it wasn't just like a repetition. It was specifically the month they're talking about.
Oh, I see. Like the 20th of June.
So if you'd write the 20th of June, you'd say 25th ditto, 17th ditto. It's kind of like opsit or all those things that we used to have to do in Ibid. Remember that in footnotes?
Yeah. I do.
Which I don't know anymore at all. So, and then it became both an adverb meaning the same and a verb, you would say, and that was in the 1700s. First, it was like just the month. Then later on, in the later 17th century, it was ditto to avoid writing the same word again. So because you're busy inscribing everything, you just write ditto. And then it became an adverb and a verb. I dittoed what he said.
Oh, wow.
But it's interesting, though. It does come from the Italian dialect variant of detto, meaning said, already said.
Yeah, I should have said that. I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's ibid, then, in that sense.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. But this leads us to today's topic. Where did it come from? Could you guess the origins of these words, Fletcher?
Can I start now? Latin.
Okay. Well, here we go, Fletcher. The word is, and it's very close to ditto, it's fiasco.
Fiasco.
What's the origin of fiasco? Okay, one, it comes from the Italian city of Fiasci in the Dolomites, famous for its frequent earthquakes. From the Latin fascis, a bundle or of rods with a projected axe. Three, a glass bottle, or actually the word being the Latin first person, to make a bottle.
Oh, wow. Well, the second one is where fascism comes from. I don't think that's the same as fiasco. I also don't believe the one about the Italian city. So I guess I'll go with the glass bottle, but I'm not sure the connection here.
Wow, that's really good, Fletcher. It apparently, this is a theory. No one's sure. But Venetian glassmakers, when they realized that a piece of glass that they were making had flaws, they would set aside the imperfect glass and turn it into an ordinary bottle. And they called that a fiasco.
Oh.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it is. That's cute. Yeah.
I like that. I like that a lot. Like, boy, look at this lousy bottle. It's a fiasco.
I know. It's a fiasco. I know.
Okay. Word number two. Quarantine. Did it come, one, directly from two Latin words, for, quator, and tinus, meaning gift of God or specified by God, referring to religious and later civil penalties and the duration of a detention. Two, from the Latin, there's a theme here, for qua, by what, and re, by what means, a legal term referring to legal government making people wait before entering the country. Three, from the Latin, quadraginta. Quadraginta, Ross. For 40, referring to 40 days of waiting.
That is the one that I would have chosen before you gave me any options. I would have assumed, I mean, I know in French, 40 is like 40. And so I would have thought it had something to do with that, the period of time that you had to wait. So I'll go with that last one.
You're two for two.
Fletcher.
Two for two. It's came this in the 1660s, the period a ship suspected of carrying disease was kept in isolation.
Okay.
From the Italian quaranta giorni, a space of 40 days. That was
great.
The perfect pronunciation.
Yes, it was.
Okay, so Fletcher's doing good. Oh, I should have added, incidentally, with the glass bottle, it's Italian dialect for flasca, which is obviously flask bottle.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Okay, moving to tragedy. Now, the origin of tragedy. From the Latin trajectus, J and I being interchangeable, so trajectus or trajectus, in many Latin words, thrown over or across. Past participle of trajere, throw across, i.e. throw away hope. From an ancient Greek word for goat, for the ancient Greek word for tragoderia, a type of sweetmeat eaten while watching ancient Greek plays.
Oh boy, I'm just going to have to pick one. So let's go with the goat. You always go with the goat.
Darn it, Fletcher. You're getting it again. Kathy, I'm quitting the show right now. This is it. We're done.
High dudgeon time.
Yes, it is. It's goat song, actually. Tragos is goat, and then the oive is song. So it's basically a goat song is called. And the question, therefore, like, why is it goat song? People dressed up as goats and satyrs in plays. Mm. And then there were other theories saying people were sacrificing goats before they watched the play or after they watched the play. The key idea is goats are in tragedy.
For some reason. Not sheep, not cows, but goats.
Huh. Wow.
You're doing great, Fletcher. We got to get him,
Kat.
Okay,
let's get him on
going.
This one. The word is shambles. We hope you make a shambles of this one.
Uh-huh.
Did that come from sham, meaning counterfeit or fake, stemming from a Northern English dialect variant of shame, or the Arabic word shama for covering, something it was intended to deceive or create a false impression, from the Old English word shamel, meaning footstool, which evolved into an area to butchery and then a mess, because you're butchering on this thing. Mm-hmm. From the Middle English, shame, from shamu, from Proto-Germanic, skamu, meaning shame, hence a shameful mess. We got a counterfeit or fake from a covering. We got a footstool. We got a shameful mess.
Yes, we do. And my answer, I'm sure, will be a shameful mess. However, I don't think I'm going to choose a shameful mess. For some reason, when you said Arabic, it was really attractive to me, even though I don't really like the counterfeit or sham or scam thing. But I'm going to go with that one, with the covering, the Arabic.
Got him this time. Got him this time.
Good work, Ross.
Thanks,
Kat. It is from the footstool.
Oh, okay.
Well, actually, because it was a figurative footstool.
Sure.
And it was the bench or a stall in a market on which goods were exposed for sale. And then they were like, so it's a meat or a fish market.
Hmm. So how did it get here? How did it get to where
it is? It began as a stool or bench. And then it was borrowed in Proto-Germanic from the Latin, meaning the low stool, which meant then just a stool. And then it was a bench or a stool on which the goods were displayed in the market. Then it was the market on which you had your meats and your fish that were being gutted. And
basically, it's a mess.
Yeah, okay.
All these animal parts all over the place. Mm-hmm. It's just a big mess. Mm-hmm. That's what it came from.
It's in shambles.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because... And I know this is a kind of a British thing, but you said at the very beginning something about it is a shambles, which is not really a phrase that we use in the U.S. I mean, I pretty much only hear it as in shambles. Like, that's the only time I hear shambles. But the British seem to use it in a little bit of a different way. I mean, like, it means the same thing, but, like, it's a shambles,
yes.
You know?
That's interesting, Fletcher.
I didn't notice I said that. Yeah.
I would say it's a shamble. Kathy, wouldn't you say it's a shambles? I would say A.
It's a shambles?
Yeah, I wonder if it's from British books we read as kids. Because I would say
in
definitely.
In shambles? I think I would say
I would say it's in a shambles, actually.
Well, again, A, right? In a shambles. Yeah. That,
in a shambles.
Which is not really what we... If we use the word shambles in the U.S., at least when I ever hear it, and I'm not representative of the entire U.S., but whatever, I only hear in shambles.
No, see, I would say in a shambles. What about you, Kathy?
I don't even know anymore. I'm trying to think. And now suddenly I'm thinking I've never used it in my life and I don't even know what it means. You know, I honestly don't know. Do I say a shambles? I think I say a shambles. I don't say in a shambles.
I would say, boy, your house is in a shambles, Kathy.
Huh.
It isn't, but I'm just saying I might say that if it were.
Thank you.
Yes.
In a shambles. Yeah, I think I say in a shambles. Yeah.
You don't say in shambles, you say in a shambles.
Interesting.
Don't you?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Now, this is another word we're going to do. Kathy says E-N-D-I-V-E. Endive, I say. Kathy says endive, apparently.
I do.
Okay, the origin of the vegetable, or the word for the vegetable. From the 1200s, dewin, to descend or plunge headfirst into water. From a merger of the old English duvan, to dive, duck, or sink, or defun, to dip, submerge, i.e. it's a vegetable grown in wet soil. From the ancient Egyptian town of Tibi, where endives were grown in the wet soil of the Nile. From the Latin en, meaning in, and divus, and the V, but pronounced divus, meaning divine figure, referring to the religious significance of the vegetable as used to accompany charred meat from sacrificial animals. 1, descend or plunge. 2, tibi a town. 3, in a divine figure.
So here's my thought process. The most attractive definition is the one about descending or plunging. But I always assumed it was from French, and the easiest way to get to French is through Latin. And so I guess I'll go with the Latin one, even though the definition is not very interesting to me as far as the answer goes.
Well, Fletcher, your logic, which is usually impeccable, in this case wasn't.
Uh-huh.
It comes apparently, no
one's
sure. We
got two in a row, Ross, two in a row.
I know, we got it, Kat. It apparently comes from the, believe it or not, the ancient Egyptian town of Tibi.
Okay.
Which sounds so wrong.
I know, it does. That one, I loved when we found that. I just loved that definition because I thought, it just sounds completely fake to me too. But apparently it's an ancient Egyptian word. And that came into the French, probably my gut feeling would be when Napoleon took it over, when he conquered Egypt. I don't know.
They say that it came from the ancient Greek entubon that got changed into endiva.
Yes.
And the entubon probably came from Tibi, which was the ancient Egyptian month, January.
Which is the Nile flood month, probably.
Right, cool. Which was when the Nile flood receded and they could grow the endives.
They could grow the stuff in the wet soil.
Cool.
Yes. That's good.
That's pretty cool.
That's really, so it isn't.
It's really roundabout. That's how would one get Tibi?
Oh, sure.
You would not.
Although, like, we should do a thing on like old Egyptian, ancient Egyptian words, because we have a few in English. Not
yeah, we
too
do.
Many, but there are a few, yeah.
The next word is bunk, as in, that's a lot of bunk. One, originated from the name of the hometown of a loquacious U.S. congressman, the town being Buncombe. Two, originally Old Swedish, bonke, boards used to protect the cargo of the ship, later used to mean, like, it's as useless as bonke on an empty ship. Bonke. Three, from bunko, spelled B-U-N-C-O, but also B-U-N-K-O, a confidence swindle that possibly came from the Italian word banco, meaning bank.
Mm-hmm.
Bunko, a bunko swindle.
Right when you said bunk, I thought of bunko. But for two reasons, I felt good about this being just straight up American. And I also think I've read somewhere that it is from the town of the congressman. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Bunkhome. Fletcher.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that's what it is. It is.
It was Congressman Felix Walker from Bunkhome, North Carolina.
Yes.
He talked at length. It's originated in 1820. He talked at length about whether Missouri should be admitted to the Union as a free state or a slave state. So politicians adopted the phrase talking from Bunkum, and that was shorted to Bunkum, B-U-K-U-M, and finally to bunk by humorist George Ade or Ade, who wrote in his 1900 book, History is More or Less Bunk. I like that.
I do too. I'm upset that Fletcher didn't get, I really was proud of these, Catherine, these two derivations.
Oh, they weren't bad at all. They weren't bad at all. I do think I've read that somewhere. And also, as soon as you said bunk, I thought, oh, American. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, the next one's sort of a weird one. Sine, S-I-N-E, as in sine, cosine, sine wave.
Oh.
Which, you know, is the ratio of the side of an angle opposite, you know, whatever, the hypotenuse crud.
Yeah.
Okay, sine comes from the Latin sinus or sinus, fold, which also came into English as the sinuses in our head. Two, from sinew, cord or thread, used in medieval times for measuring angles. Three, from sinope, an ancient Greek colony where Pythagoras developed his mathematical skills.
That's cute, but I don't think that's it. I just assumed it was Latin, so I'm going to go with sinus.
Fletcher, you're doing it again. Yes, you're right. This is really interesting because this derivation is actually based on a mistake. The Arabic word was jibba, which is the cord of an arc or a sign, which they took from the Sanskrit jia, bowstring. But it was confused with another Arabic word when the Greeks took it up, jayib, which is a bundle or a fold in the garment. And then from the Greeks and the Latin, when the Latins took it up, I mean, then from there it became in the jayib basically was translated into sinus, which is a fold in a garment. And then sinus, the fold in a garment, obviously talks about holes in our head, which are sinuses. And then from there it came into the regular word. So it's all based upon a mistake, which is interesting.
Funny, yeah.
Which is very common, those false etymologies.
The next word is porcelain. Is it from the Italian word for little pig, which porcelain bows resembled, possibly because of the curved back on the little piglets. Two, from the French town of Porcelain, famous for its wool making. The town's name was first used for fine woolen goods, but it was also where craftspeople first copied Chinese porcelain, and that name was later transferred from fine wool to the fine china. Three, from an early transliteration of the Chinese city near modern-day Shanghai, Pokela, where the Chinese exported their wares. Oh, we have four.
I put four here. I wasn't thinking.
Ross, you're overachiever.
I know.
Four, from the Greek word bursa, translated to the Latin persa, where it came into medieval French when combined with lain, literally referred to small woolen and cloth purses, then to the protective covering of fine pottery, transferred then to the pottery itself.
Fun. Those are all good. Two things. One is that before you gave me anything, I just assumed it was a transliteration of Chinese, so I'm going to go with that. But I very much regret that I am not choosing the little pig, because in every other circumstance, I would choose the little pig.
And you should have chosen the little pig.
Good. I'm happy that was it.
Yep, it is little pig. Yep.
Okay, so what's the Italian porcolini,
porcella.
Porcella.
Porcella. Porcella, a young sow, feminine of the Latin porcellus, young pig. Yeah, because we have porchetta. Randy makes a nice porchetta, which is a grilled pork thing. I don't see porcelain, though. It's funny. I mean, that's very evocative, but mm-hmm. do porcelain bowls don't really remind me of the curved back of a pig?
Well, there's interesting enough, there's basically a derivation, though. The one thing is that it probably first came from the little piglets looking like cowrie shells. And cowrie shells, which were called, they were called little pigs in Italian. And cowrie shells, you've seen them. They're really shiny and all that. Mm-hmm. They're really shiny. And we got them when I was, at the Red Sea and stuff. And they're like, I mean, they really stand out. Mm-hmm. And they're shiny like porcelain. So I think it's really kind of like it was sort of a cheaty thing. Because it mm-hmm. basically came from, first they look at these little porcelain, porcellas in Latin, which they look at and they look at these little shells. And then they go from there to the pig. And then they go from the pig. But then first the pig looks like a thing. And then from there it goes porcelain shell. Then it goes into the porcelain pottery.
Okay.
One thing I wanted to say quickly, I'm so glad you chose, I really feel happy that you chose the Chinese city. Most of these derivations are like based upon real ideas. I couldn't get a good, decent Chinese city, so I made up Porcella completely. I never heard of
good
it.
Good work, Ross. Wow.
Rachel, you really made my day today.
Wow.
And I'm going to talk about the Chinese city of Porcella from now on.
My goodness.
Good work.
Okay, let's do, which one should we do, Kath? Average. Now, meaning one, damaged goods, possibly from the Arabic awariya. Two, from verge, meaning rod or staff, from the Latin virga, a symbol of authority. Thus, to be within the range of such authority was to be within the verge, hence to Old French, a verge. From the German, vergeld, a sum of money paid to a family or a person for a life, especially to a Germanic, according to Germanic law, according to Merriam-Webster, and from there referring to the average amount of money. One, damaged goods. Two, verge rod. Three, vergeld.
I like vergeld how it sounds. I love German when it comes
to
vergeld.
I do too. It sounds cool.
The Latin into the French.
Oh,
no.
Fletcher.
Oh, no, good.
Fletcher. We're hitting you.
And you're
here.
Usually far above average.
Yeah.
It actually came from the Arabic. Oh. And the Arabic, basically, it started out as a small charge over freight costs payable for financial damages. Uh-huh. Then from there, it came into the French avarie, damage to a ship. Then Italian avaria, and then from there, Spanish avaria, and then it came into the Romance languages. And it says, quote, the OED, few words have received more etymological investigation.
Huh.
And they say, thus, when the safety of a ship in distress, any destruction of property is incurred, either by cutting away the mast, etc., it is basically a proportionate value should be paid.
Wow.
And then it became, then they came equal sharing of this loss by the interested parties. And then from there, it came into equal sharing and average, the average mean proportion.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
That is really interesting. Huh. It sounds a tiny, tiny bit familiar now that you read all that out. I mean, not all of that, certainly. But
what gets me is that the whole mathematical concept of average didn't come into being until the mid-1700s, which is a long time when you think about average being used as a very specific thing about maritime.
That one really bothered me, that sense, because the sense of average, like being, you adding stuff, the average age of this family is, I just can't believe that's true. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
I'm looking right now at the OED because it bothers me too. Yeah, it's all shipment of goods. It's all damage.
Oh, that I believe.
Distribution.
Then
the
I
mathematical,
believe.
The final one is 17. They have it as 17.
Oh, but the word. Oh, but that. Well, what we're saying, the word was that was became the word. That's where the word got in. Yeah.
Oh yeah, the concept of an average.
The concept is ancient.
They probably used like 89 words for it though.
Yeah.
They didn't have like average. You would, they'd go on, and you'd be like, "All right,
we got to pare this down, guys."
Yeah.
But I mean, like, you know, what are you doing when like you're, you know, I don't know, like you're building the Colosseum, and the guy goes, "How much, you know, how much are you spending for these bricks?" And he goes, "Well, the average amount." What did he say? I don't know.
A fair amount, okay?
Yeah, no. Five
denarii. Wine. Okay, the final word, since this has gotten that way, is weird. Which, this is, and we've got a little twist. Which verb is weird related to? One, to warp. Two, to turn. Three, to wiggle.
They all seem okay. There's some little thing in my head that says it's to turn, and I can't quite remember why, but for some reason I think that's what it is, to turn.
Well,
is that your final answer?
That is my final answer.
You're right.
You're right.
Okay.
However, had you chosen warp or turn, you also would have been right.
Warp, turn, and wiggle. All three.
Wriggle.
All three.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, this comes from a very early Proto-Indo-European word. And the idea, I mean, Kathy, let's just read some of the words it's also related to.
Adverse, anniversary.
Avert.
Avert. Awry.
Controversy.
Converge.
Converse.
Holy cow.
Convert.
Diverge.
Divert.
Evert.
I've never used evert. Extroversion.
Extrovert.
Okay. Gator. Introvert. Invert. Inward. Et cetera.
Vertigo. Vortex.
Oh my
gosh. You got them all.
Peevish.
Yeah.
I like peevish.
Oh,
in
really?
There.
Peevish is related to weird too. Wow.
Yeah. It's from a very early word meaning basically to turn or to roll, and it's all over the place.
Uh-huh.
It's also related to words, things like worm, because worms turn. So basically you're getting everything in that one.
I just want to throw in that I'm sorry, I'm going to be weird here. Do you guys know the difference between wiggle, W-I-G-G-L-E, and wriggle, W-R-I-G-G-L-E?
Oh.
I've always wondered. I just looked it up.
Well, wriggle is turning the body.
Right.
And then, wiggle is a back and forth.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow.
I thought that wriggle and wiggle were the same thing, just different spellings. I mean, one comes from Germanic, Middle English, wiggle without, it's related to cradle. And wriggle, which I pronounce wiggle, is Middle Low German. It means to turn or to twist.
The one question I have is, I know wriggle is related to weird. You said wiggle. And I'm curious, is wiggle related? Does it have the same thing or not? I was wondering if
I
was wrong about that.
See, now that's because I pronounce wriggle, wiggle.
Okay, because actually, Kathy, Fletcher, that's what I thought. When Kathy said wiggle, she should have said wiggle, because wiggle is related to weg, which is not a Proto-Indo-European word. So, Fletcher.
This is how etymologies get fuzzy and muddy, you guys, is. Somebody pronounces something wrong and then tells everybody that
that
would be me. I never said wriggle. Wriggle sounds very wrong. I always thought wriggle was wiggle with an R.
This is really fascinating, Kathy, because, I mean, literally when we did it, I wrote down wriggle, and then Kathy said wiggle, and I was like, wriggle, not wiggle.
No, so, I know, because I thought, oh, it's got the R, but it's still pronounced wiggle.
But it is interesting what Fletcher said. Herein lies the problem we had, you know, with sinus earlier. Herein lies, like, a problem of, you know, mishearing things, and then we go on with it. It's really interesting.
I never have said wriggle in my life.
How funny.
I know, it's so interesting.
Today I am a woman. I mean, I don't know.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petrus records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petrus from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. Our digital team is Beth Golay and Carly Cooper. Carly Cooper is also our video editor. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org, or email them at kandrpetris@gmail.com. You can also record a voice memo of yourself asking your question. You might get your voice heard on air. Or you can download the KMUW app and press the Talk to Us button. You can find Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.